Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Red, red, and more red. What do we have to do to get a good day on Wall Street? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, August 16th. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. We're going to start today by taking a look at the week that was. We call it the Weekly Wrap, a little live radio with Felix Salmon from Reuters and the End of the Suburbs author Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Hey, guys.
Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, Lizzie.
All right, so we have had kind of a rough week on Wall Street. We got a sell-off in the equity markets, but also the bond market. Felix, what is going on here?
Bond prices, but bond yields are going back up to vaguely normal levels. Stock prices are not going up anymore because people are worried that companies aren't going to be able to make more money. So, yeah, it's a bit uncomfortable if you're one of those people who cares about what the markets do from day to day, which those of us who are smart never care about, right?
Never care about. I mean, is there an argument that we're due for a little bit of a pullback here? Things have been ripping along before this. Lee?
You could certainly say that. You know, it's funny. I mean, the market and the overall economy have been two really pretty divergent stories for the past several months. And this week, they kind of converged a little bit. I mean, there's been a tremendous amount of unease about the economy, whereas the stock market has just been, you know, shooting to the stars. And so this was sort of a reality check a little bit. And we saw some not-so-great earnings results from two big bellwethers, Walmart and Cisco. Walmart being a bellwether for the consumer and Cisco being a bellwether for tech and business spending. So that's sort of scary making.
All right. So Felix, I'm going to indulge your tendency to talk about broader things than the markets. Let's talk about Europe. We had this little moment of like, yay, maybe they're out of recession.
They're out of recession. Germany is pulling Europe out of recession and France isn't doing too badly either. Europe could actually start really being part of the global economy and helping the world to grow again. And when I say Europe, I mean Germany and France, because as far as I can make out, the rest of Europe has basically fallen off the map at this point.
But come on, Portugal did well.
Well, you're right. Lizzie, we think alike. Totally. 4.4%.
I mean, that's a big improvement. Do you see this as a real improvement, or is this a numbers glitch? Blip?
I think that it's a little too early to start, you know, popping the French champagne, although France did well also. I think that, you know, there's still tremendous unemployment problems plaguing all of Europe. And, you know, I mean, remember back when we were all talking about green shoots. I mean, I think we've all learned not to jump the gun on being overly optimistic, but certainly it's a really good sign. And at the same time, you had a lot of emerging market growth pull back a bit, so which isn't entirely surprising either, but it was sort of a reversal of sorts.
All right, so I'm going to kind of stretch this analogy and go from one sort of European thing to another. The London Whale. We had actual charges brought not against the London Whale, but two other former J.P. Morgan traders. I guess I'm curious, Felix, is this the end of where the charges go, or are there still more folks to fall in this, do you think?
This is it. I call them the London small fry. The London Whale gets off because he's giving evidence. And all of the senior people, Ina Drew, Jamie Dimon, the people you might have heard of, they're untouchable. So they get a couple of people that no one's ever heard of towards the bottom of the food chain, and that's the best they can do. It's quite pathetic, really.
Well, Lee, I'm curious about this because there was maybe some rumbling when Mary Jo White, the new head of the SEC, came in that we were going to see a more muscular SEC. Now, we've also seen these things come from the Justice Department. So is there anyone else who's going to fall, or are we out of it? We are running up against the statute of limitations and the financial crisis.
Right. Well, Preet Bharara of the U.S. Attorney's Office here is on quite a tear, especially as regarding insider trading. So I think we'll see more there. With the SEC, I mean, we might see more. This has all proven to be very difficult to actually try and convict anyone for actual criminal wrongdoing. But one thing I think is interesting is that it looks like J.P. Morgan may admit ultimately to wrongdoing, which is very rare. That hardly ever happens. So,
and the consequences of that would be significant. Why?
Symbolic. To me, it's significant. Nobody ever does that. I mean, it's, you know,
nobody ever
says
we screwed up here.
Yeah, there's been this whole pattern of paying millions and millions of fines, and that's it. And the deal is that you don't have to admit you did anything wrong. So forever and ever in the record books, you're clean. And not that, you know, admitting wrongdoing is so. It is anything more than that, but I think that that's an important
unless
change.
You lose your banking license.
All right, all right, all right. I'm going to let you two argue this out in the rest of the studio. Thank you both, Lee Gallagher from Fortune, Felix Salmon from Reuters. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, Lizzie.
On Wall Street today, a rough end to an already gloomy week. Details when we do the numbers. There's that old saying about turning a crisis into an opportunity. Well, here's a twist on that, turning confusion into opportunity. The confusion is just over how Obamacare is going to work as it gets rolled out. And the opportunity? Scams. Lots of scams. Marketplace's Christy Clark fills us in.
How much do you know about those healthcare exchanges opening up in October under Obamacare?
I must admit that I am not as well-versed as I should be.
I mean, I know there's exchanges, but I don't know how one would go to sign up for an exchange.
Don't know anything about it.
I talked to those three people, Saeed Haig, Eric Morton, and Stephanie Talavere, on the street in downtown L.A. today, and I think they speak for a lot of us.
There's a lot of confusion.
Sally Greenberg is the executive director of the National Consumers League.
This is a heyday for the scammers and the fraudsters of the world.
Hello? To get a sense of how these things go down, I had Greenberg pretend to be a scammer on the phone.
Did you know that you have to have insurance and you could be in some serious trouble with the law if you don't sign up, including going to jail?
That part about jail is not true, by the way. But I'm in luck, my scammer tells me.
We're offering a special deal right now where you can get insurance for $29.99 a month. All you have to do is give us information about your bank account.
This is where you should be hanging up the phone. Same goes for offers to buy Obamacare cards. There's no such thing. If you do get a call or email like this, you should also report it to the Federal Trade Commission, says Lois Greisman with the FTC.
We want complaints. They are an enormous source of rich information for us. There are investigative leads.
She says they haven't sued anyone yet, but they've already gotten around 1,000 complaints about scams and expect more as we get closer to October when the exchanges actually open. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg stirred up some controversy this week when her organization, LeanIn.org, went looking for an intern. But that internship was unpaid. A lot of people said, wait a minute, Lean In was created to help women get ahead in the workplace, so it seems like paying them would be a part of that. Well, it turns out that when most women take internships, they aren't making money. Marketplace's Noelle King has the story.
Women do tend to take more unpaid internships than men. A 2009 study by the research group InternBridge showed women are about 77% more likely. Why?
They just feel like guys wouldn't accept that as easily.
Rose Courteau spent the summer as an unpaid intern at a luxury lifestyle magazine in Washington, D.C. She wants to work in PR. And in her experience...
The guys that I know, a lot of them are going into professions that are less creative type professions. They are iBanking, consulting.
I'm going to say it before you can. That sounds a little off. There are women in consulting and finance. But it turns out Rose's anecdotal experience is right on the nose. Phil Gardner of the Collegiate Employment Research Institute conducted that internship study. Gardner says women are more likely to major in subjects that lead to internships in education, social services, nonprofits, and, like Rose Courteau,
women are big in communications, for example, and I know that 55% of the communications, advertising, public relations internships are unpaid.
But Gardner says a paid internship isn't necessarily better.
We've got really good unpaid internships, and we have crappy unpaid internships, and we have really good paid internships, and we have crappy paid internships.
The difference, says Gardner, is that if you get a not-so-great internship in engineering, you're more likely to get a good job anyway. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
The death toll in Egypt keeps mounting. At least 60 people were killed today, and that's after thousands of protesters faced off against police who were authorized to use deadly force. Well, we wanted to know what it's like to run a business in Egypt in the middle of all of this. We reached Ahmed Al-Kousi by phone in Cairo. He's been at one of his businesses all day, protecting it with his employees. And the phone can be a bit hard to hear, so you might need to listen closely. Ahmed Al-Kousi, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Lizzie.
So give me a sense of your business. You run a series of stationery shops in Cairo, is that right?
Yes, it is, yes.
Do you worry about the safety of the people who work for you?
Of course, I do worry. I'm the general manager of the company, and we were all gathered, about 20 people, we were together, ready with the buckets of water, buckets of sand, fire extinguishers. And we were behind the windows. So it was a really tough and a rough day.
How do you make a plan to go forward when there's so much chaos going on?
We were always going through all kinds of crises. So we got lots of experience to live the day, every day by itself, to work on a daily basis. So what I'm sure about, that tomorrow we are going to open all our six showrooms and the head office as well. What would happen after tomorrow, I still have no idea.
Well, Ahmed Al-Kousi, stay safe and thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, where in the world is Kai Rizdal?
I was at a food processing plant where they are making prepackaged meals here in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, that will, in probably a week and a half, be on lunch trays for kids in the Los Angeles Unified School District.
An update on the American Futures Project. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average deflated a further 30 points, or 0.2%, to close at 15,081. The Nasdaq slipped 3 points, 0.1%, to end at 3602. The S&P 500 fell 5 points, 0.3%, and finished at 1655. For the week, the Dow gave back 2.2%, its biggest weekly drop this year. The Nasdaq was off 1.6%, and the S&P 500 slid 2.1%. Once again, sluggish retail sales took a swipe at investor confidence. Nordstrom cut its profit forecast for the year, and shares of the department store chain got cut by nearly 5%. Joseph A. Bank tumbled 7% after the men's clothing retailer said quarterly results would fall short of its projections. Bond prices continued their retreat. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.82%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. National Aviation Day is celebrated at the Wright Brothers National Memorial in North Carolina. In Little Rock, Arkansas, a Senate subcommittee on communications, technology, and the Internet holds a field hearing. It'll focus on connecting urban and rural America, the state of communications on the ground. And former president and governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton, turns 67. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdal. There's a lot of those reference books in the For Dummies series. PCs for Dummies, Excel for Dummies. Now comes Wine for Dummies. But it's not a book, it's an actual wine. The bottle has the same yellow and black color scheme as the books do. You can buy Wine for Dummies Pinot Grigio, or Wine for Dummies Chianti. You get the idea. Marketplace's Queena Kim reports on, why.
Wine drinking's up in the U.S., but winemakers are still struggling with its snobby reputation. Mark Tucker is with Vision Wine and Spirits, the company selling wine for dummies.
A lot of people are intimidated by wine, and we wanted to make it more accessible for everybody.
But within the category of everybody, Tucker's got his eye on one group.
We are looking for millennials.
And millennials, the generation born between 1980 and the early 2000s, they're looking for fun. That's given rise to concept brands, one of the fastest growing segments of the wine market. It's wine that's known for its cool and sometimes funny label, and not for the esteemed winery it comes from. Yellowtail is a popular one, and there's also Ménage à Trois. Nancy Light is with the Wine Institute, an association of California wineries.
Some of the millennial consumers like to go to a party and bring something that's going to make a statement or maybe be a conversation piece.
Now, that runs counter to everything I was taught about wine, and that is, don't judge a wine by its label. Turns out, I'm dating myself.
I noticed that the older people, they appreciate the wine even more than my generation.
That's Primrose Lorenzo. She's 31, works in finance, and drinks wine. If you saw Wine for Dummies at the store, is this something you'd buy?
I just might, actually. As long as the label is catchy, that's what I look at. It's just wine, alcohol.
She says as long as it tastes good and gives you a buzz, what else could you want? I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Sports are very, very lucrative viewing. Something ESPN, the self-proclaimed worldwide leader in sports, has proved. This weekend, Fox is getting in on the action. They're launching two sports channels. KPCC's Ben Bergman looks at why going after ESPN has become, you guessed it, such a popular sport.
When most people think about ESPN's majority owner Disney, they think Mickey Mouse, theme parks, or movies like Snow White. But it's actually Disney's cable networks, led by ESPN, that now bring in over half the company's operating income. David Bank is a research analyst at RBC Capital Markets.
The majority of the value in Disney right now, which is a $50 billion corporation, is coming from ESPN.
This should really be Disney's theme song. Fox sees ESPN as a bit too stuffy and self-reverential. It's branding itself as a looser alternative with hosts you'd want to have a beer with after work.
We're the one making sports fun again.
It will be an eclectic bunch on Fox. There's everyone from Regis Philbin to former tennis star Andy Roddick to Jay Onray and Dan O'Toole. They hosted a wacky Canadian version of SportsCenter.
I'll never retire from this job. I'll have to drag my dead corpse out of here. Hi, everyone. Welcome to SportsCenter.
But to really attract big audiences, Fox can't just talk about sports. Media consultant Chris Bevilacqua says it has to show them live.
The success or failure of not only Fox Sports 1, but any other multi-sport national network is going to be driven by the value of its live events.
No one knows that better than Fox. Developing a national sports network has been a top priority within the company for over a decade. Executive Vice President for Programming Bill Wenger says things got serious when Fox was able to get more live events.
When the rights became available over the last 3 years, that's when things really started to gain momentum and we started to put the plans together.
Fox has been on a spending spree, snapping up rights to NASCAR, U.S. Open Golf, Major League Baseball, and college football and basketball. It wants to add bigger prizes, the NBA and especially the NFL, in coming years. In the best case scenario, Fox Sports would do to ESPN what Fox News did to CNN, bring down the market leader. But at least initially, Wenger is setting modest expectations.
Our success will be measured in years, not days, weeks, or months. Our initial ratings will probably be pretty low.
Before it's even on the air, Fox has a solid head start. Most new cable channels struggle to get picked up by cable operators. But by taking channels it already owned, Speed and Fuel TV, and turning them into Fox Sports 1 and 2, Fox solved the distribution problem. That leads analyst David Bank to conclude something about Fox no sports team could ever dream of. They can't lose.
It actually feels fairly riskless, which you rarely hear a financial analyst say. It's just a lock that it's going to be massively profitable.
Banks says that's because Fox has already negotiated higher fees with some but not all cable providers that are multiples of what it was getting before with Speed and Fuel TV.
The great thing about this business is that the risk has been mitigated massively by the concept of monthly affiliate fees.
Bank estimates Fox already had $1 billion of revenue from those fees coming in before it sold a penny of advertising. That's a lot, unless you compare it to ESPN, which collects an estimated $7 billion a year in subscriber fees. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bergman for Marketplace.
It's almost the end of summer, which means many people are wrapping up their very first job. We're asking people to tell us their first job stories. What you learned, what stayed with you, what was humiliating, and what you still think about.
My name is Michael Price. I am a writer and co-executive producer on The Simpsons. My first job was working at a women's clothing store in a mall in the little town I grew up in called South Plainfield, New Jersey, a store that I think is not there anymore. It was called Burt's, and it was a kind of a specialty mid-range women's clothing store where I was the stock boy. And I inherited this job from a friend of mine who had left the job. It was my senior year of high school, and it was the first job I drew a paycheck on. I cleaned the floors with one of those kind of mop thingies with a big, long, wide wand. I broke up boxes, and I put the boxes in the dumpster. And I spent the rest of the time sort of hiding in the back room or spending long times in the bathroom because I didn't like the job very much, but I needed the money, probably around $38 or $40 a week. It was a very simple job. Like I said, I didn't have to do very much, but I didn't like being among people. I didn't have to sell anything, but occasionally I have to sort of open up boxes full of, you know, women's clothing. And it was all sort of embarrassing to me because I grew up in a family of all boys. I had no sisters. I was painfully shy around girls. And here I was working in a women's clothing store where there are women and girls walking around all the time. And I really had no clue what to do about it. I spent my break times going to a little bookstore across the hall in the mall where I just sort of spent my time reading books about what I end up doing now, which is TV and comedy. So I spent all my money on those books about Saturday Night Live and Second City TV and things like that. Well, the one thing I could say about my first job is that it really did help sort of inform my writing as a comedy writer because it was an incredibly awkward situation. And looked at objectively, if it was a TV show or a movie, it would be pretty funny. The nerdiest geek, you know, working, you know, with these sort of somewhat stylish women, you know, and having really no clue what to do about it. And that, I think that sort of helps inform my writing even today of sort of like looking for juxtaposition of people forced into a situation that really makes no sense for them.
That was Michael Price, a writer for The Simpsons. I worked at a sandwich shop where I learned that people really don't pick up after themselves. We want to hear about your first job stories, funny, sad, shocking. Tweet them to us at MarketplaceAPM or email us at letters@marketplace.org. You may have noticed that while I've been here hosting, someone else's voice has been missing. Kai Rizdahl has been off on a very cool assignment, and we decided to let him come on and talk about it. Hey, Kai.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So where are you? What are you doing?
I'm in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, as promised on Monday when I spoke to Jim Fallows. He and I are working on a project with Marketplace and the Atlantic Magazine, sort of going around the country, trying to figure out what the American economy is like at ground level, where people actually live, and learning all kinds of things about Sioux Falls, South Dakota, which, believe it or not, has more to do with the American economy and the global economy than you might think.
All right, well, you teed that up. Explain to me what it has to do there.
So I'll give you a couple of just for instances. I was at a food processing plant 2 days ago where they are making prepackaged meals here in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, that will, in probably a week and a half, be on lunch trays for kids in the Los Angeles Unified School District. That's one thing. I was driving a GPS-controlled tractor yesterday that can plant seeds within an inch of each other, and then a month later come back and put fertilizer on that exact same inch using GPS control.
Whoa.
That factory, yeah, I know, it's cool. That factory is selling to tractor companies in Kazakhstan. So Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and the global economy are sort of one.
South Dakota has had a really low unemployment rate over the past couple of years, much lower than the national average.
Sioux Falls, the unemployment rate is 3.7%. I just looked it up this morning. Nationally, 7.4%, as you know, so it's just about half. But here's the thing. Low unemployment is not necessarily a good thing. I was talking to the president of the Chamber of Commerce of Sioux Falls last night, and he said companies are actually worried about coming here now because the unemployment rate is so low. There's not enough churn. There aren't enough people looking for jobs to make companies interested in coming here. So it's kind of a problem for them, which is a little bit counterintuitive when you think about the national story of unemployment being so high.
Yeah, very, very counterintuitive. All right, yeah. Kai, I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of what you've been doing out there. Thanks so much.
All right, it'll be on the air after Labor Day, and I'll see you Monday.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, if equity markets make you nervous, and understandable in a week like this one, perhaps you should consider cars. Classic cars. The Economist magazine put together an index of fancy collectible items. Art, wine, coins, guitars. But the thing that really outperformed over time was classic cars. An index of the 50 finest Ferraris, Porsches, etc. increased by 53% over the past 2 years. The entire valuables index is up by more than 200% over the past decade. Certainly beats the S&P. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow deflated 30 points, or 0.2%. The Nasdaq slipped 3 points, 0.1%. And the S&P 500 fell 5 points, 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Satara Nieves. And the executive producer is Deborah Clark. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Have a great weekend, and we'll meet you back here on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.